believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit and spent a portion of many years in Africa. She earned a pre-med from Harvard and a doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Basra University. For 2 years, she worked in the integrative medicine department of oncology services at Beaumont Hospital. And since 2014, she's been the founder of Associates of Integrated Medicine, which helps you, your medical oncologist, and cancer care team to help minimize or prevent side effects of conventional cancer treatments and preserve quality of life. Her name, Dr. Sheba Rourke. And I'm Jack Rizzullo, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rizzullo. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the founder of Associates of Integrative Medicine, Dr. Sheba Roy. Doctor, welcome. An honor to have you.
Honor to be here, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, which wasn't normal, and your parents, please?
Absolutely. So my mom is Mauritian. She was born in a strict Muslim family off the south. It's an island off the coast of Madagascar. As a young person, she was often hungry, passed days without food. She was all bone and jaw, but there was no room for complaint because her parents were viciously proud people. But I think that kind of stink of poverty and having to beg for food and being subject to the indifference of others made her who she is today. She has kind of a kinship for those that suffer. She's a Detroiter now and is a clinical neuropsychologist who specializes in trauma. My father is from what was once Pakistan, is now India. India used to be one massive large landmass. India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh were all one landmass. And then during World War II, that landmass was divided and there began a mass migration of Hindus south and Muslims north. My father was a child, was disguised as a little girl, and walked through these killing fields where some of the largest massacres occurred in human history, and was witnessed a lot of those atrocities. His mother died during that crossing, and he migrated 2,000, 3,000 miles south to Calcutta, where he spent most of his childhood. He also, like my mother, had a childhood that was characterized by starvation, violence, displacement. During partition, that migration, 15 million people were displaced, more than a million killed, hundreds of thousands never made it, and 700,000 women and children were victims of sexual violence as a feature of war. So my parents themselves are kind of extraordinary people who made it through extraordinary circumstances and ended up in Detroit.
You spent many summers growing up with grandparents in Africa. What did those summers and your grandparents teach you?
So that's an interesting question. So it was more than the summers. It was approximately 5 months a year. We were half of the year here and half of the year there. My father was Hindu. So when I was here, I was raised in temple. I had a guru and was very invested in our community here. And when I was in Mauritius with my grandparents, I was raised in a strict Muslim household where I was taught self-respect and the integrity of my relationship with God and kind of the features of faith. I really learned that how we show up in the world is a reflection of our relationship with our Creator, and that I was brought into this world because I had a gift to offer. So yeah, that's what I learned from them.
After graduating high school, you lived and worked with Mother Teresa in Calcutta in pediatric hospice. Talk about that portion of your life.
Yeah, that's right. So that kind of really all started with my parents again. So my dad had founded St. Joseph Medical Center in Detroit, which was a large full facility clinic that served the greater Detroit area. And he started me really young in that clinic as a janitor because he had read books about great Americans like Lee Iacocca and Abraham Lincoln and believed in starting from the bottom up. And so he really cultivated in me a strong work ethic and a servant heart. I started as a janitor and moved forward in terms of the kinds of jobs that I did working with vulnerable populations. And my dad taught me that self-respect was a way of showing respect for others and that to be of service to those who had less was of the highest value. When I was 17, I decided to go work with Mother Teresa. My parents were completely against it. At the time, there was no such thing as the kind of poverty tourism that exists now or large volunteer organizations that work with people who are suffering. It was a time where that was an unusual decision. And I lived and worked with her for originally 6 to 8 months. And then I went back every 3 years after her passing. I worked under Sister Nirmala with Missionaries of Charity. Did you have a question about that?
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mother Teresa?
So I worked originally in pediatric hospice, which meant that every Thursday morning, women would bring babies and hold them up in the air and beg for the nuns to take their child. And they would choose maybe 30 or so of the ones that seemed the most distressed or the most suffering. And we would kind of shepherd them through their last days of life mostly. I learned that the parameters of human suffering are kind of elastic in the sense that what we know the human mind to be capable of withstanding and enduring is really limitless, and that the body is really this this very ephemeral or time-sensitive shell that houses something so much stronger, something so much bigger than we could understand, which is the soul. As I moved forward and I worked in adult hospice, one of my duties was as people would be brought in off the street, women would be brought in off the street, it was my job to bathe them and de-louse them. And the kinds of starvation that you saw there, their limbs would be atrophied like a bird almost. Just turning in on themselves, their heads, they could barely hold their skull erect. They were all teeth and eyes, yet they still had a sense of dignity. They might have an earring in or a small bracelet, or they would push my hands away when I would be washing the most intimate parts of them. And I was really struck doing that work by the human spirit, by the soul itself, and how it shines through even the most broken of vessels. You know, I lived with her and with Mother Teresa, that is, and I prayed with her and I worked with her. And I don't like to talk about her personally and her person because I've never felt that it was appropriate to capitalize on suffering like that. But I will say that she saw her life as a living example for selfless action, not necessarily faith itself. And that to me was a really important lesson that everything I do is in service of the world around me and not necessarily coming from my will or my desire to be good per se. Does that make sense?
We're talking to Dr. Sheba Roy, and I'm Jack Prasula. And this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Dr. Sheba Roy, who is a natural medicine doctor who works to preserve quality of life, prepare patients for surgery, and optimize outcomes using nutrition, lifestyle, and natural therapies. How was it you decided to become a doctor?
I always knew I wanted to be a doctor, Jack, because my dad was a doctor and he was my hero. And I was on a very conventional path. As you said, I did pre-med at Harvard. And I went to Hopkins actually on scholarship for international health policy, and I was going on to med school there. But I was a pretty strong-willed child, as you can probably tell it in terms of the amount of traveling I'd done by then. And I refused to take money from my dad because I felt like if I did, then I couldn't make my own decisions about who I was going to be in the world. So I always worked after school, on the weekends, overnight shifts at jobs that kids could do, everything from working in a factory to fast food to driving a delivery truck, delivering newspapers, to pay all of my own expenses. And one of the jobs that I did do was I ran support groups while I was at Hopkins for patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And they were on multiple drug cocktails. And what I was really surprised by is the amount of side effects from drug treatment and what patients went through when they were on the other side of the table. So in terms of being a doctor, I had always worked with patients, always worked in medicine, but I'd always been on the side of that power differential where I'm delivering care and not receiving care. And it was really just profound to me how much people went through on the other side of that table. They kept asking about natural therapies and side effect management. And that's what motivated me to leave Hopkins and do my doctorate in natural medicine. But it was a 6-year doctorate, so it's a combined degree between 4 years conventional and 2 years evidence-based and alternative therapies. And at that point, I decided to subspecialize in cancer in a field called integrative oncology because one of my closest people did get cancer. And I felt like this would be an extraordinary space to move into that would bring a lot of my talents to bear. So there were 6 fellowship positions in the country in integrative oncology, one of which was at Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia. So I wrote my own acceptance letter 4 years before I applied, and I mailed it to myself and opened it and put it on my bulletin board and really set my focus to achieve one of those 6 positions nationwide. And I did. And so I'm one of 75 or so integrative oncologists in this country and Canada. So that's why.
When we were young, we didn't hear of cancer. Surely not a 25-year-old woman with breast cancer or a 2-year-old kid with, you know, eye cancer. Why so much cancer today?
That's a really good question. I think the world has really changed in terms of how the environment that we live in, the quality of soil, the quality of food, the access that we have to manufactured and engineered products. I think the way we move is different. I think the way we live life is different. And those changes have resulted in changes in how our genes manage inflammation. I want to mention, because I think this is important let me move forward from there. So I think that's the main reason we're seeing newer cancers earlier is because the rate of pro-inflammatory factors that cause cells to make mistakes in the first place is rising.
You have a degree in natural medicine and you're known as a natural medicine doctor or a naturopath. Talk about natural medicine.
So natural medicine in Michigan is kind of, and in many states, is kind of a wild, wild west or a little bit like being a second class citizen in the sense that it's not well regulated. It's not regulated at all in Michigan. Anybody can call themselves natural, holistic, integrative. That doesn't mean anything here. So patients are very, very vulnerable, especially cancer patients, when they're looking for what actually has evidence that it is effective and does not interfere with their conventional treatment. And in the oncology world, there's many oncologists at some of the larger hospital centers who refer to us. 60% of our patients come directly from oncology. However, there's many more who are unaware of the real and robust data around natural therapies, nutrition, and lifestyle in mitigating side effects from treatment, but not just mitigating side effects from treatment, but once this patient has gone through cancer treatment, lowering risk of recurrence and optimizing survivorship. So this person thrives rather than just survives. The fact of the matter, Jack, is that the model that we have for cancer care is somewhat broken. It's a wheel that only turns and rocks side to side. It's not a wheel that continues turning clockwise. As when a patient is diagnosed with cancer in this country, they see a medical oncologist who is the kind of the captain of their ship. That person's responsible for prescribing chemotherapy. The medical oncologist will then refer to a surgical oncologist who recommends surgery, or a radiation oncologist who recommends radiation. If that person is lucky, they may also have a nurse navigator or a social worker. But in some hospital systems, there's one social worker for 2,000 patients, and that is what is considered a comprehensive model for cancer care. That, to me, is largely insufficient and inhumane, in fact, when there's so much data at how other parts of the medical world can contribute to outcomes or prognosis. If medical oncology is referring to naturopathic oncology or integrative oncology, then that person is also getting natural therapies to prevent long-term effects and short-term effects from chemoradiation. So, for example, protecting their heart, preventing their diabetes, protecting their gut, so that they can not just survive, but thrive. In my clinic, we also refer to nutrition oncology, who are subspecialists who not just know how to use food, but use food as medicine, how to design and cultivate a relationship with nutrition that's truly healing. Those people refer to mental health also in our practice, which are counselors that are oncology trained in how to approach death and dying, anxiety and depression, fear, spiritual integrity, changes in identity, and so on and so forth, so that that wheel, instead of turning on its side, continues to turn all the way around. And we have truly a holistic model that looks at what these other powerful pieces are. And I will say that the mind is one of the most powerful pieces in care. In 2013, I accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior and became a Christian, mainly because of a sermon that I heard about the sacrifice, and that helped me to have a more personal, intimate relationship with God. I have a lot of respect for my faiths of origin, and I think they really contributed to my understanding of how the role that the soul plays on this earth. But I think that that piece is really important as well, because when people hear the word cancer and what they hear is, I'm dying. And in that place of fear, it can be the most fertile ground to really explore your relationship with God. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? Who loves me? Who doesn't? And we rarely have the chance to ask that conversation. So in our practice, we see cancer as an opportunity to have that conversation in many different ways. And I think that's what's really missing from that model of cancer care.
We're talking to Dr. Sheba Roy, a most fascinating lady. And if you want to learn more, www.aimnatural.com. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Prisula. We're talking to Dr. Sheva Roy. And in 2014, she founded Associates of Integrative Medicine. Doctor, tell us about that and its services.
So as I mentioned before, it's a clinic that offers a multidisciplinary approach to cancer care that takes advantage of the actual data that exists in natural therapy, nutrition, and mental health to help a patient achieve the outcomes that they're looking for. For example, we now know that patients who do guided visualization during chemotherapy or before and after have significantly less side effects from chemotherapy. That includes nausea, sleep disturbance, and pain. And those that significance can be 26%. You know, the data is just really, really strong. And that is really what our clinic tries to do, is harness that data and integrate it into a truly holistic model for care. We like to work directly with oncology. We don't see ourselves as in opposition to chemoradiation. Chemoradiation can be and are really important foundational tools. They're just not, it's like trying to build a house with a hammer instead of with a wrench and a screwdriver and all the other tools that you may need to build that house.
What do you say, doctor, to a listener tonight who has just heard those words, you've got cancer?
So my approach with patients, Jack, when they come in, we spend an hour and a half in a first office visit. We don't do 5 to 15 minutes. So we really get to know the patient and their families. And my approach is to really look at what's driving their fear. I believe that fear is the devil, or whatever you believe in. It's an opposing force that interferes with your ability to think clearly and experience love in each living moment. It's really the only tool that opposing force or devil, whatever you believe, has at its disposal. But because it distracts you from the gift that God placed in you and what your reason for living is. I don't think, you know, I think we all talk about what is the cure for cancer? What is the cure for cancer? I think the reason we haven't really come close to a cure yet is that we don't really understand the metaphysical and the spiritual nature of that conversation. And I think that's one of the things that perhaps the multiplicity of faith and my personal history gives me. I think that the cure for cancer lies at the intersection between oncology, immunology, quantum mechanics, and spirituality, meaning cancer cells is a cell that's decided it wants to live forever. It's one cell that's made an individual decision that it wants to live forever. We're not meant to live forever. Our bodies are not meant to live forever. Our souls are. But there's something about our human nature and something about the way that we cling that we want to live forever. We're perpetually searching for the fountain of youth. And I think that human failing or that human error is one of the things that patients have to confront when they hear that word. And in that space, if you're very careful and you're very deliberate and you truly see and love this person in front of you, you can find a way to navigate the conversation so that they're able to find a place to stand and live, not in fear, but in love. And in that place is where the healing actually happens. We have miraculous results with patients because they actually stand in hope and belief and faith, even when they're not believers, rather than standing in fear.
If you want to learn more, www.aimnatural.com. I quote you now, there is no way around it. You must go through it.
So yeah, there is no way around treatment. You must go through it. So how do we go through it other than being well-armed with the best of care. And I think that's just super, super important. I was mentioning that in the cure for cancer is a conversation between these four fields. So here's this one cell that's decided it wants to live eternally. And that's the mistake it makes. It continues to make daughter cells that want to live eternally. And that's how a tumor is formed, because it continues to grow and break out of the space it's supposed to be in. That's exactly what cancer is. Immunology is a field that looks at how viruses and other organisms co-opt our own cells' machinery in order to grow. And that's what cancer cells do. They co-opt the natural machinery of the cells around them in order to build a blood supply to themselves in order to survive. Quantum mechanics looks at, really, are we our bodies? Is there matter at all? Or are we energy? Are we another way? Is there another way to look at the human body? And spirituality, whether it's priests or popes or prophets or poets, looks at the potentiality of the soul and what really is eternal in our life. And I think the intersection, the conversation between those four fields is where we'll start to really see potential for cure. But until then, the best we can do is returning a person to optimal health following treatment or slowing progression so they have the highest quality of life.
Okay, I quote you again. This one you really go on out on a limb. It's not the drugs that heal. It's the belief that heals. Really?
So I'm surprised you remember what our original conversation, what I talked about and wrote it down. I didn't expect to be quoted. Yeah, you know, as a doctor, that's a really risky thing to say, isn't it? You know, we want to believe that our drugs are the end all and be all. And that's just not true, because we know, for example, there's such a thing as placebo effect. So at least 40% of the time, and sometimes far more than that, a person can be given a sugar pill and will not experience pain, or will respond as though they've been given a medication. Why is that? It's because the mind has a lot of control over how the body experiences the world around him or her. And you can think of the mind as the spirit, right? So I think as cancer professionals, we all know that there's a high level of burnout in my field, a high level of despair, because in essence, we're giving drugs that have a huge potential for harm and a very narrow margin for healing. Yet it's what we have. There are advancements being made in the field with targeted therapies that can look at a single mistake, a single type of mistake that a cell is making, but that we're still not there yet. We still haven't been able to, in medicine, erase the knowledge of all of human history, which is that we are not our bodies. We are our souls, and our mind is very powerful in helping us to drive ourselves to a state of true health.
We're talking to Dr. Sheba Roy. If you want to learn more, www.aimnatural.com. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Pasula, host of WJR's Anything is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything is Possible. And we're talking to a most fascinating doctor, Dr. Sheba Roy. Everybody that she's helped and every family that she's helped say the same thing, that the care you show your patients, if and when their final hours are coming, it's unbelievable. You treat them like family. Why do you do that?
You know, maybe that comes from my work with Mother Teresa. Nobody's asked me that question as to why. When I did the work that I did with her, I saw people in states of suffering that in states of decomposure that you really couldn't begin to imagine. You know, people who where critters had eaten into their limbs, you know, and cleaned white bone, where their skin would fall off in my hands, where you would shave their heads and just, you know, large fat lice would just run all over your arm. Just things that you never see or really understand. And I think I learned then, or what became really palpable for me then is, again, we're not our bodies, we are our souls. So when I am with, and the nuns at Missionaries of Charity, they take a real literal vow, which I think is true of all Catholic nuns, which is that they believe that in that act of service, that person who's suffering is indeed the body of Christ himself. As he said, you know, as you care for another's body, you care for mine. And that is a literal vow for them. And so I think I learned and I absorbed some of that in the sense that I do see each patient as not my family, but something even more near and dear to that. Almost I see them as an extension of myself, that we are all one body, if I can crib from Hinduism, and each one of us is a cell within that body. Each one of us is a piece of that consciousness, and there's no separation between me and that person. Maya Angelou once said, never allow yourself the crutch of thinking that what another human being has endured or is capable of, you yourself will not endure or be capable of. I think that quote speaks to that oneness of human consciousness. And I do have a real sense of that when I'm working with patients. We do a lot of work in death and dying. We don't talk about it often because it's something that really scares patients. I wouldn't say many of our patients die. I have 2,000 patients and a long wait list, but we only have maybe between 4 and 5 patients pass per year. And when we have the opportunity to walk those patients to their last breaths, it's truly actually more of a gift to me than it is to them, although they may not know that. We just get to be present in the most extraordinary ways and see people demonstrate love in the most extraordinary ways. Death is like birth. So you're delivering the soul. It's messy and it's dirty and it's chaotic and it doesn't look the way you want it to look. But it is a delivery of the soul, and the body really deforms in that process and changes in that process. And that's truly terrifying for the family. So part of what we do is normalize and soften that experience so that not only can the person go through it painlessly, but also so the family can truly be present with that patient and not be living in that space of fear. Marriages are particularly important in this space because that's when you really live out those vows. I think when people take the vows of in sickness and in health till death do us part, they don't truly understand on a physical, emotional, spiritual level what God is asking for them. And in that moment, the ask comes to bear. The request is made patent. And I have seen extraordinary acts of service on the behalf of husbands who were terrible husbands or wives who were distant wives, who are able to be present in a way that truly shepherds this person into their afterlife.
We're talking to Dr. Sheba Roy, the founder of Associates of Integrative Medicine. Talk to us, if you will, about the importance of what we eat in preventing cancer or recovering and thriving after cancer.
That's a great question, Jack. There's two answers to that, or two pieces of that. What we eat is powerful. What we put on our fork is powerful, not just because it impacts our health, but it also is a political decision. Everything that you put on your fork is attached to industry, is attached to geopolitics, is attached to a gasoline cost, is attached to global violence. So it's really, really important to start thinking about food as a form of resistance, resistance to the medical system, because once we're sick, it is the most costly thing we'll ever do is try to heal from it. Prevention is critical. So 60% of cancers, at least in yours and my generation, are lifestyle related. And eating a mostly plant-based diet, eating a little bit less, and eating whole foods are really the only three rules you need to follow. Nothing fancy, just eating mostly plants, eating a little bit less, and eating mostly whole foods. That's the gold standard in a cancer-fighting diet. In terms of survivorship, once a person is diagnosed with cancer, what they eat during treatment is very different from what they need to eat after treatment. During treatment, it's really important to keep weight on. And unfortunately, there's a lot of predatory information out there about cancer and sugar or cancer and nutrition. So patients hear about how to starve cancer or the metabolic contributors, and they start dieting once they're diagnosed. That is almost a fatal decision, because losing weight, the cancer cells they're very metabolically active. So they use fat and sugar really efficiently. So if you have one pool of fat and sugar, and cancer cells and your normal cells are using that same pool, but the cancer cells get there faster, we lose weight really fast. And that makes it hard to tolerate treatment and hard to survive this disease. So very important during treatment not to restrict. But after treatment, or while in survivorship, what we think about in survivorship in the lay world, it's really important to strategize with an individual nutrition strategy that's targeted towards your specific, not just cancer, but your specific heart risk, your specific metabolic risk in terms of diabetes, your weight, your age, your sex. All of these pieces go into how a nutrition program is designed for our patients post-treatment.
Dr. Sheba Roy, thanks a million for being a great guest. Thanks for all you do for so many people in the toughest times of their lives. Keep up the great, great work.
I appreciate you, Jack, and I appreciate the work you're doing to inspire people the countrywide.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Brasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.